Hi, it's Evan from Good Food. Before we start this week's show, I have a big announcement. KCRW has decided to cancel this Sunday's Good Food Pie Fest. We are aware of the campus protests at UCLA and believe it's in the best interest for all to cancel. Bakers, I understand how beautifully you embrace this gathering and how seriously you take the competition aspect. We see you at markets looking for the best fruit and watch you on social sharing your ideas and excitement. It's why I love this Pie Center community we've created. Thank you to everyone who poured their heart into preparing for this year's event. We will keep you posted on any updates on our social media channels. And now, on to the show. From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. The last time I sat down with Chef Dookie Hong and journalist Matt Rodbard was 8 years ago upon the release of their book, Koreatown, which explored the rise in popularity of Korean food across the U.S. Proving Korean food knows no borders, they've widened their lens on the cuisine with their latest venture, Korea World. Welcome back, you two.
Thanks for having us, Evan.
Thank you so much, Evan.
I'm so happy to have you. I mean, there's been no slowing down of the reach of Korean cuisine across the globe. As a person who, you know, is really lucky to live in a city that has just a huge Korean diaspora with all of the amazing food that that entails, I mean, to me, you can't divorce the food from the huge explosion of Korean pop culture globally. I mean, music and film, it's permeated our own culture.
Well, of course, this is Matt. And, you know, the gateway has been significant from the film industry and from television. And obviously, if you scroll on Netflix and you look at your grid, you're going to see something from Korea. And for a country of only 50 million people, the soft power, so to speak, coming out of Korea is tremendous. I mean, the global influence of the cinema and film industry, or the cinema and television industry. So with food, we're seeing a similar globalization and interest, and we cover it not just in Korea, but in America. And really with the book, we were really attempting, and I believe we succeeded in crystallizing a modern Korean cuisine or modern Korean vocabulary for food. And it's not the canon. It's not the barbecue. It's not gamjetang. It's not the so-called uncle food that we wrote about in Koreatown almost a decade ago. This book really kind of captures the modern spirit of Korean cuisine. And really through the recipe list, it's pretty different than some may think.
I know. I find it really interesting, this interplay between cuisines that are represented by kind of ossified versions that were created and remembered by immigrant home cooks, which often is the first wave of restaurants that we see when immigrants move to the U.S. But then there's the reality of how food constantly changes in the home place.
Yeah, I mean, it's so right. I mean, the home kitchen is not all about tang and guk and jjigae, so to speak. It's about V60 pour overs and Gilgari toast, which is a recipe Dookie developed, inspired by Queens up in San Francisco. So a lot of the recipe list is pulled from our experience traveling in Korea and through America. And of course, Dookie's experience, lived experience, as a Korean American chef, and really the great change in the cuisine. I mean, I feel like, you know, our coffee section and bakery section in Korea World really says something. It says that the modern Korean cuisine is not ossified, as you say. It is moving. It is at the speed of light. And really what we did with our stories throughout the book, our Citizens of Korea World, we captured the essence of this change through modern food.
Can you explain the concept of Hallyu?
Yeah, Hallyu or Korean wave, the literal translation I would say is the Korean wave. It's a cultural phenomenon. Why is, you know, a bunch of non-Koreans dancing in the streets of London, dancing in the streets of Brazil to Korean K-pop music? Why are my friends that have nothing to do with anything Korean, they're no association with Korean, telling me about the latest Korean drama that came out on Netflix, right? Even when I don't know. And this probably like was really hitting, maybe started in the 90s, but really hit maybe in the last 10 15 years, and then it really got this boost the last 5 years and 6 years, and that's why we really felt compelled to document it one more time.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much. I have to say that, you know, one reason why I love Korean, you know, soaps is the food. And I feel like I'm a fly on a wall watching what is actually happening when people go out to eat in Korea or make food at home. And it's just so enjoyable. And
are you a Dr. Wu fan?
Oh, my God.
You love it?
So much.
Isn't it great? I mean, Kimbap, just the way Kimbap comes alive with that show. And to your, I love your point. It's so accurate. It's like the food and the way it's served in Korea. And Duke and I have been really fortunate to go to Korea many times. It's quite different from even Los Angeles, which is truly the epicenter in America of Korean cuisine. It's so different. And like Professor Wu gets you really excited about Korean food. It's such a great observation. Mm.
So can you kind of dig down into that difference and maybe pick one menu item or a range of dishes?
I think we each can take one. I'll take one to start. I think the difference is this. In Korea, it's not Korean food. It's dinner or it's lunch or it's late night or it's a snack. And I think what we've done is we've crystallized these recipes that have been, some of them have been fad. So we go over like dalgona, which was a big fad a few years ago. But we have a dish like rose tteokbokki, which is a traditional tteokbokki rice cake dish. But with the, you know, the inclusion of cream in the sauce, which we saw in Korea quite a bit. Another is like vongole. Like we've seen exploding interest in Italian cuisine in Korea. And we have a vongole recipe in a Korean book, which, you know, I think is probably the only Korean book with vongole recipe. Mm. But it made a lot of sense for us. So it's this idea that modern Korean cuisine doesn't really know any kind of stricture. It really is expanding at the speed of light.
So that vongole, Duki, is it a traditional vongole or is there a twist?
Yeah, I would say, and this is kind of akin, I would say, to maybe even why Japanese people talk about, or like people talk about Tokyo pizza and whatnot. It's a very influence from just, and we're going back to the globalization, the flow of information. I can, with the tip of my fingertips, know exactly what's happening in Italy and the vongole over there. Koreans the same. I know exactly what's happening, not in Korea as a whole, but that region, that town, like what they do. And I think the Korean vongole per se is, I would say, I mean, strong garlic presence, but ingredient-wise, very Italian. It's just kind of how hard you put the garlic up front, which Koreans love garlic, Asians love garlic, and how back you put kind of the olive oil because of that kind of that. In Korean, it's called nukki, which we're not like that oiliness. We're not maybe too big fans of. So we'll put it to the back seat instead of the passenger seat. So ingredient-wise, very similar. Clams, like beautiful, fresh ingredients. But it's not like, hey, it's vongole and here's kimchi on top of it. That's not what we're talking about. It's really Koreans even being like, hey, this is the best vongole, Italian dish. We recognize that it's an Italian dish and its roots, but we like to eat it this way.
Yeah, we had these breakthroughs throughout our trips and travels. We would go to Jeju or Gangwon-do. We went to Jeolla-do and experienced some temple cuisine there. But we were surprised around every corner about how our interpretation of Korean cuisine was changing almost in real time.
There's this one page you have in the book, the 17 best things we ate in Seoul and around Korea. Could you pick something else from that list and kind of break down kind of the evolution of it away from the traditional, or if it's something like brand new?
Yeah, I could take one and then Duki maybe take the next one. So one that really stuck out to me was at this restaurant, Hojokban, which there's actually a location in New York City now, and they're doing kimbap, but with a truffled tuna mayo. And to me, the idea that kimbap is, and we see it in K-dramas as we mentioned, kimbap can be so many different things. And to bring truffles, which even like 10 years ago or even 5 years ago was only reserved for the like Pierre Garnier's restaurant in Seoul. But now like truffle mayo is part of kimbap. And it had a really nice, finely ground perilla powder on top of it. And like the kimbaps too were half the size of what you would find, you know, on 32nd Street in New York or out on Olympic Boulevard in LA. It's very different. It's like almost like a fine dining version. But when it came down to it, this was like only 10,000 won, which is about $8 a serving. So the point with this dish is that it really illustrates how like Western cuisine and Western sensibilities are being done in Korea in a way that I wouldn't call it fusion. It's its own kind of way now, and it's exciting.
Mm.
Dookie, could you talk about the moo kimchi granita?
Yeah, that's a recipe that I've come up with a long time ago, actually, more than 10 years ago. And it was my influence working in Centrico, which I guess not a lot of people know with Chef Aaron Sanchez. And the idea of hot, cold, like temperature being a source of flavor, a vehicle for sensation and whatnot. So it's not just sweet, salty. It's like, okay, we can play with temperature as well. And for me, the muri kimchi granita, a lot of people kind of ignore the liquid that comes out, the beautiful, beautiful cabbage kind of liquid or the muri kimchi liquid that comes out. Decided to freeze it, granita, learning that technique from Centrico and applying it to oysters, applying it in noodle dishes. I think Korean cuisine, we play with temperature really well, like hot kalbi, hot Korean barbecue with cold noodles, even with the granita, cold on really cold, you know. So let's have a fresh cold oyster and let's put an even colder shaved ice granita.
Yeah, I just love that idea so much of this icy, icy kimchi, because I love the icy, icy soups.
You get
noodles.
It.
So you write that a visit to Jeju Island, which is referred to as the Hawaii of Korea, changed the way that you prepare fish at home. What did you learn and from whom?
what an adventure, Dookie, we had. Do you remember?
Yeah. I mean, Maddie, you share way better about this part, but I'll add on.
Okay. So, Evan, we were in Jeju Island, which, again, is the Hawaii of Korea. Everyone should go there. It's really its own, has its own foodways. They have this famous black pork, but they also have a horse meat tradition, which we tried, which was a little bit more mild than you'd imagine. But really, we were driving around and found this little seaside restaurant that was doing a whole, it was kind of like a porgy fried.
Mm.
And what we saw them do really gave us this idea for the recipe, which was they brought the fish to our table fried, and they drizzled on this gochujang-based sauce, which was kind of like the gochujang you would get with like a Korean fried chicken. And instead of it being served delicately and having each customer pick apart the whole fish as you would at any restaurant, the owner put on some gloves, some plastic gloves, and proceeded to literally smash this entire fish, breaking up the meat from the bone. And we were like, this is crazy. But then when they left it, we were like, this is actually amazing, because it's really given us this easy way to enjoy the fish. And really, it separated the flesh from the bone, but it also created this like kind of like bibimbap. It was like a little bit of a mixed vibe. I mean, Dookie, what else did you take from that?
I mean, outside of the flavors, it was, I mean, the presentation piece of it and the joy of that, the textures, like even those cartilages you're eating. And it was actually really good. I mean, I think the sauce was incredible, but it could apply to any sauce. It was just that way of eating that I felt was, okay, like we're in the middle of essentially nowhere. There's no signs here. There's no like Yelp rating here. And these, this couple, I remember it was like my parents' generation couple, like this is all they do. Like every table has this fish and it's this presentation piece. It's the texture. It's the familiarity of fried, but not familiarity of like, hey, I'm okay. I'm picking out the bones as well. Yeah. It was kind of eye opening for me.
That dish is, I just love the photograph.
Yeah.
It like gives you, it gives you permission, you know?
I like that.
Yeah. We love the recipes in the book. We think it's actually quite doable. I think frying a whole fish with a cast iron pan and really it's easier than you think. And it's just such a set piece for a dinner party, I'd say.
So I would love it if you would tell us what chefs or cooks should we be paying attention to now here in LA?
I mean, Evan, this question is so loaded. We have so many friends You are blessed with some of the most talented people in the world. So Dookie, I'm just going to say a couple names and you can say a couple names and we'll go back and forth. I mean, I think we've got the folks at Yongban. Yongban's just doing just something that is hard, which is the banchan that is transcending any banchan I've ever had, using pears and acidity. And I think Perilla, what Jihee is doing down in that cool little spot down on the east side, and I'm not sure she's been on your show, but I think Perilla as like a concept is really modern in that it's a daytime cafe doing doshirak, like box lunches, but also this incredible banchan shop.
Yeah, to put a pastry mix in there, one of my favorite cafes is Smoking Tiger. And they're more in the OC, right? So just to give a little greater Los Angeles love, Smoking Tiger, one of my favorite spots, really big Korean influence, incredible drinks. Like shamelessly, Korean is in the forefront. Misukaru, injarmi, they don't shy with it. Even their pastries, they put a yakgwa, which is a very, very traditional, like our parents' generation eats this dessert. And it's on top of like a croissant. They just do things really like, if you had to say, this is a Korean cafe, I would say Smoking Tiger really embodies that and our good friends over there.
Perfect. Oh, that's so great. It has been so wonderful to get to have this time to hang out with you guys and talk about this passion that you've expressed in Korea World.
Evan, such an honor to be on your show. We love what you do, and it's just really great to talk Korean food in the center of Korean food in America, at Los Angeles.
Evan, thank you so much.
That was San Francisco-based chef Dookie Hong and journalist and editor Matt Rodbard. We've been discussing their follow-up to Koreatown, Korea World, a cookbook. We've got a recipe for their Korean-style vongole on our website, as well as a link to buy tickets for their launch party happening this Friday, May 3rd. If you listen to the show via podcast, you might not realize that Good Food is a part of KCRW, an NPR station based in Santa Monica, California, and we share our airwaves with a whole slate of incredible culture shows. On Life Examined, host Jonathan Bastian covers issues surrounding philosophy, science, faith, and humanity. This week's episode features a wide-ranging conversation with journalist and author Michael Pollan. He discusses everything from psychedelics to coffee to the new documentary, Food Inc. 2. Here's a clip.
The fact is that food produced by an industrial system is cheaper than food produced humanely, sustainably. And part of that is we don't force the food companies, the big food companies, to pay all the costs of growing food the way they are. You know, a city of 500,000 or a million people has to clean up its waste. A feedlot of, you know, 50,000 head of cattle doesn't have to clean up its waste. You know, we had this expression, make the polluter pay. And this was a founding idea of the environmental movement, that if your way of doing business is adding pollution to the environment, you were responsible. That's not true in the food system. So the problem with getting these food companies to actually pay for the pollution and other costs to society of the way they produce food is it will increase the price of food. And that's never politically popular. Anything that increases the price of food is anathema to politicians. Going back to the French Revolution, I mean, you lose your head if that happens.
You can listen to the full episode by searching for Life Examined in whatever platform you use to stream your podcasts. And if you're in Southern California, you can catch Life Examined every Sunday at 9 a.m. on 89.9 FM KCRW. Can some of the best cookies in Los Angeles really come out of a gas station? Find out when Good Food continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now. at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Can some of the best cookies in Los Angeles really come out of a gas station? Well, if they're Zooey's cookies, yes, they can. Sold out of a United Oil near the corner of National Boulevard, they've been winning hearts and stomachs in West LA for almost 8 years now. Founder Arezou Appel is our guest for this week's In the Weeds.
Hi, my name is Arezou Appel, and I'm the founder of Zooey's Cookies. I was born in Tehran, Iran, and I lived in Tehran till I was 5 years old. And I would say food had such a special meaning to me because I think my parents, very strong personalities, disagreed on a lot of things, but one thing they did not, and it was such a pleasant time to be in, was when they were talking and making food. My mom would make food in a way that was, for me, magical. She was a principal of a school and she was inspector of schools, but she just loved food. And my dad, the same thing too. He was an educator himself too. But food was a time that everything looked and felt amazing. You know, looking back years later, I think that's why my daughter says, "Mommy, one of your love languages is food." And the food we had was, you know, traditional, really good Persian food, which is very healthy. There's a lot of herbs and vegetables. Even in Persian cooking, fruits and nuts are used. And as well as, you know, she would do non-traditional Persian food because we lived here from the time I was 5 until I was 7. And that was right before the revolution in Iran. And so the food from here also became something that she was making. You know, Persian culture is very much so education, and the artistic side really didn't have that much of a value. So I became a chiropractor, acupuncturist, herbologist, and I practiced for 8 years. Then I went to, I studied Chinese medicine, then I went to China. I did a rotation at the Beijing Hospital, and I loved the field I was in. I loved healing people, making their pain go away. But that's when I met my husband, we got married, and right after I got pregnant and had our first child. And for me, always, it was so important to raise my own children. You know, in Confucianism, each part of the society is the family unit. And to raise good human beings is the most important thing you can do. And basically, I became a stay-at-home mom. And what I did is just, you know, taking care of my two children, Sophie and Charlie, and then cooking. And I remember they were little. They, one would hold one leg, one the other one. I would be cooking. I would be giving them taste of food to see what they think I should have. I mean, we're talking about they were little, really young. And they would tell me, like, this food needs a little bit more turmeric, more lemon juice, more saffron. I mean, they had good taste buds too. And when my oldest at the time was going to preschool, I saw cookies are coming into the picture. Kids are bringing cookies. And it wasn't something I could avoid anymore because we were not really eating sweets and cookies. So I said, since she's going to have these, I'm going to make the best version that I feel comfortable. So at least I would feel comfortable, good about her eating it. I would go to stores and I would ask them, like, do you use butter? Do you use hydrogenated oil? And there were cookie stores that they would say, we use hydrogenated oil. And to me, like, you know, that was one big thing that really had to be avoided. And they were using it. So I started making cookies at home only for, you know, that my two children and my husband. And I remember one of the times my husband said, wow, these are really good. And, you know, we started a cookie business in the gas station that my husband owned. And it still didn't sink in that these were really special until like 3 months after opening. I would just see people coming and going, and the reaction, the looks on their eyes, how the eyes would open, or the sounds they would make after eating a cookie, that really started feeling, wow, this is something special. The fact that Zooey's been being in the gas station became an important point because it's a convenience factor. People would come in, get gas, and they would get their cookie. And if they didn't want to get gas, there was parking there. And in fact, now there are cars that are electric cars that they come in and they park and they come to Zooey's. So, you know, at the beginning, gas station part of it was like a convenience factor. But it has continued that way, whether it's an electric or a fossil fuel car. When we started, I remember the first year. Got a little easier second year. But when we started, let's say 50 cookies, when we started that first few months, we started growing. We're up to 2,000 cookies a day now. There's some days that we do actually more than 2,000, but I would say an average 2,000 to 3,000 a day. So Zooey's cookies, the way we make the cookies, and in my mind, we have to have different texture and different flavors. If it's just one tone and one note, the taste buds would become bored. So the reason we the cookies are more crispy on the outside and the middle is softer, that difference of texture, when you bite into a cookie and you get the exterior that is a bit of that crunch, and then you dip into and sink into the softness of the center. At the same time, when you have different notes, let's say of chocolate, we mostly use different dark and milk and semi-sweet. When you have different notes, the balance also of the butter and the salt in there creates like a fun party, I would say. And it's a fun bite to have to eat a cookie. We make everything from scratch in the gas station, from the graham cracker that goes into the s'mores cookie to the marshmallow. And it is a lot of work. I mean, I had an office as a chiropractor, healthcare professional. The amount of work that goes into food, it's so much. None of it would be possible without the team we have. I am so aware that the world is made out of so many different types of people and needs. And I also wanted always Zooey's to be a place for people that everybody's included. And that's why we do have gluten-free, we have diabetic-friendly, we have paleo, we have vegan. I'm so excited about this new line that I'm making, the cookies that have no gluten, no processed sugar, no dairy. It's plant-based and vegan. And they're delicious. And they're made out of really great ingredients. We have like a pumpkin spice cookie in a way that has none of the things I mentioned. But it has so much flavor that my kids, my husband, myself, in fact, the staff at Zooey's, it's like our favorites. Like for breakfast, most of us, we have that. We have a brownie that is vegan, but it has a lot of flavor. I worked on brownies to be vegan for a long time. I was never happy. But until bringing sweet potato, we roast the sweet potatoes. And in Chinese medicine, sweet potato is so good for your health. Having half of it, it's so good for balancing your hormones. So our blissful brownie has no sugar, flour, butter, made with sweet potatoes and a lot of almond butter. Anybody who can come in with any dietary restrictions, but they still can enjoy having something with their tea or coffee.
That was Arezou Appel, the founder of Zooey's Cookies, which has become locally famous here in Los Angeles. Where can you find them? In a Cheviot Hills gas station. For more details, head to our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. KCRW's Pie Fest may be canceled tomorrow, but that doesn't mean that the bakers aren't baking. Contest or not, it's always time for pie in my book. So I wanted to invite Jennifer Yi, pastry chef behind the famous vegan croissants at Baker's Bench, to talk about the most consistently challenging category at our annual pie contest, the vegan pie category. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Evan. Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad you came here to talk about this because I feel like it's kind of a difficult conversation. What are a few of the biggest mistakes, in your opinion, that bakers make in this category?
I feel like one of the biggest mistakes that I see is sometimes people are trying to aim too high or overachieve. As a judge, what I'm looking for is just a good pie. That's what I'm looking for. I don't need to have a good vegan creme brulee pie. I would be so happy with a vegan blueberry pie or a vegan strawberry pie. It doesn't have to be an over-the-top thing because that's where things can go really wrong.
Yeah, it's always amazed me how few just simple fruit pies are submitted in that category. And a fruit pie is actually the easiest thing to make vegan.
I would agree. You would just have to change the crust since the pie component is already vegan.
So let's talk about the crust and the tweaks that one needs to make. There are so many plant butters now that are available to use in a crust. I've had good results with Earth Balance sticks. Mm-hmm. Do you have any plant butter that you prefer over another?
I would say for the bakery, we use two kinds of butter that aren't available to home bakers. And so I would say for the home baker, if you're just going to your average, well-stocked grocery store, maybe your Whole Foods, I would recommend Miyoko's. I know people have had a lot of success with that. I like the flavor of Earth Balance, but I think it can get a little bit waxy when you're using it for baking. I think it can get a little waxy, a little greasy. So I would say maybe a blend of the Miyoko's, which is going to have the fat and the solid structure to make the flaky pie crust, and maybe half that and half Earth Balance for flavor.
And what about plant-based milks? This year, bakers are very restricted in the dairy they're being allowed to use, but plant-based milks are fine. Does soy milk give a creamier result for certain fillings than, say, oat or almond milk?
I would say it depends what you're going after. Each different kind of alternative dairy will give you different results. In my baking, I like using a blend of oat milk and a blend of soy milk. Soy milk has protein in it, which will help your pastry's color. Protein, when it goes into the oven, undergoes Maillard reaction, it helps your crust color. And I also like to use oat milk because it has some of the oat milks on the market have a really nice toasty flavor. And usually, not always, but usually they have some oil and fat emulsified into it, which when you look at milk itself, it's protein, water, and fat. And that's kind of what you're trying to emulate as a substitute.
So what about that creamy filling? What ingredients work best for texture, flavor, and stability? So often by the time we see the pies, they can be a bit kind of a watery mess.
Yeah, I did. I do remember that happening last year where once they're sitting out of the fridge for a period of time, they're weeping or they're separating and they're kind of just watery, like you said. What I would recommend if you're trying to go for some kind of maybe chocolate cream pie, chocolate mousse pie, I think coconut milk is a really good substitute because that already has the fat and the water content that you're looking for. Other than that, for creamy textures, I like good old-fashioned tapioca or cornstarch to hold everything together.
Yeah, definitely. People are allowed to make meringues, but what do you think about an aquafaba meringue? Will it hold up over the hours that it takes to deliver the pie and judge it?
Unfortunately, I don't think it does. And we saw this happen last year. it by the time it's sitting in the sun or whatever weather we have that day, the aquafaba meringue just kind of weeps and melts and it looks very sad. I think you made a good point, Evan. I think simple is best. I'm really excited to see what people add this year. If I had one piece of advice, I would say if your filling is too sweet, add a little lemon juice, add a little salt, really balance out that flavor. And also in your pie crust, please add a little sugar to that. I like to use maple syrup in mine just to make sure your pie crust gets some color in the oven. Our brains, when we see brown pastries, that says tasty. And that's what we want to see. We want to see tasty pies. And I'm so excited to see what our bakers offer.
That's true. And I would say that given that we don't have a savory category this year, the vegan category is kind of like an omnibus category because there's no meat in it. So if people want to make like a vegetable pie, you can do that in the vegan category.
Yeah, I would love to see a vegetable curry pie or like a chicken pot pie, but vegetables.
Oh, that would be so good. Well, thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me.
That was Jennifer Yee. Her brick and mortar location for Baker's Bench is barely a month away. You can keep abreast of the timeline on her Instagram at bakers.bench. In a minute, is it possible? Friend and fellow pasta fanatic Dan Pashman inspires us with countless ideas for pasta that go well beyond carbonara or bolognese. That's next. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Back in March of 2021, I embarked on a journey to air my opinions about pasta in service of Dan Pashman's quest to create a new pasta shape. The resulting narrative arc, dubbed Mission Impossible, was aired on Pashman's podcast, The Sporkful. The resulting shape, Cascatelli, is hugely successful. It was named one of the best inventions of 2021 by Time Magazine. So we have the pasta. Now, what do we do with it? The inveterate tinkerer with opinions has ideas. Dan's new cookbook is Anything's Possible, again with the puns. Hi, Dan.
Hello, Evan, my pasta fairy godmother. It's great to talk with you.
Welcome to Good Food. So after a grueling period of time and innumerable obstacles and opportunities, you made your shape, Cascatelli. It gets marketed. Then people start to do what people do, use it in a way that invariably disappoints you. Am I right?
Well, I mean, I'm not invariably disappointed. I'll take issue with that part of your characterization. But they started sending me pictures. Everyone's sending me pictures of what they're making with Cascatelli, which was very exciting and gratifying at first until I realized that 75% of the pictures I was getting sent on Instagram were Cascatelli with tomato sauce, meat sauce, mac and cheese, and pesto, which are all fine sauces. I'm not against them, but it's just an awfully narrow range. And, you know, putting Cascatelli aside, just in terms of pasta in general, this just made me sad to realize just how limited the options are for most Americans. And it made me realize that even me, myself, I fall into that red sauce rut too often. And so that was where the seed was planted for the cookbook.
So interesting. I just love how individualistic many of us are and how we fall into culinary ruts at home. The other day, a friend told me that she made a new pasta that involved breadcrumbs and she was blown away and had never heard of this. And I told her that we used to grind up the lovingly made croutons at Angeli and used them liberally in several pasta dishes. Your book opens with a chapter that includes pan grattato. Tell me what they are and give me a couple of takes on yours and how they're used. I have to say that I am extremely drawn to the Ritz cracker and chive combo.
Yeah, yes. So pan grattato in general are seasoned toasted breadcrumbs used on pasta dishes and other dishes in Italy. Typically there, though, it's going to be some basic breadcrumbs, maybe garlic, oregano, other herbs. I'm a huge texture eater. And so I devote an entire chapter in this cookbook to pasta dishes with a range of different textures. As you know, Evan, in Italian food culture, they combine different textures in pasta. Certainly across the range of Asian noodle and rice dishes, they vary the textures. But I just think that in America, a lot of the pasta dishes that people are eating at home are somewhat monotextural. And I think that sprinkling seasoned toasted breadcrumbs over a pasta dish can absolutely transform it. It takes 5 or 10 minutes to make one of these. You can store it in the freezer and takes your whole pasta dish to another level. And so rather than just the sort of basic breadcrumbs and garlic, like you say, there's a Ritz cracker and chive pan grattato. There's a one with crushed corn nuts and lime zest, a lime corn nut pan grattato that
I love it.
It's so good. I mean, you can eat it with a spoon. You don't even need to sprinkle it on anything. That one is phenomenal. We have a furikake pan grattato sprinkled over a mushroom pasta dish that is so phenomenal. And so, you know, to me, you can season breadcrumbs with almost anything. And so I try to sort of let my imagination run wild and to incorporate the texture of pan grattato. And also it's a great way to just add a subtle note of an additional flavor into a dish in a very simple way.
Yeah, I think I would include the Ritz cracker and chive combo atop a clam pasta, maybe.
Oh, I like that. The buttery taste of the Ritz. I get that. That makes a lot of sense.
And, you know, people might be surprised to hear me embrace these sort of global pantry mashup ideas of yours. But, you know, when I was cooking my restaurant and I was representing Italian food, that's one thing. Or when I wrote my cookbooks, that's one thing. But how I eat at home is sort of much more loose and kind of jazz inspired. I mean, that's kind of my style. Years ago, I think I spooned chili crisp into a burro in parmigiano and discovered that it was just like the most phenomenal thing ever. So take me through a couple of your favorite discoveries along the way of this project.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is exactly what you're talking about. You know, I think that we tend to think that new ideas in food come from fancy chefs, but often it's just home cooks who, like you, Evan, you have a few different things in the pantry and you end up combining them. And that's what I often do, like you. I do the same thing in my kitchen, which is how I ended up with recipes in this cookbook for things like cacio e pepe with chili crisp or kimchi carbonara or mac and dal. Or shakshuka and shells with preserved lemon. Or, for instance, there's a classic Italian pasta dish of artichokes and lemon that Italians would typically do with lemon juice. But instead, I'm doing it with preserved lemons. You get more funk, more savoriness. It just sort of, to me, takes the dish to a whole other level. Frankly, these are ingredients that I already cook with and already have in my home. I mean, the mac and dal idea came to me because I had leftover dal in my fridge and I had leftover pasta in my fridge and I needed lunch that day. And I was like, I'm going to mash these up. I'm going to put these together.
It's so good.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. And it's also like, I think that a lot of the ideas in this cookbook are frankly a natural extension of the fact that our cuisine is becoming more diverse, more different flavors and ingredients are working their way into the culinary mainstream across America. I certainly cook with a much wider range of ingredients than I grew up eating. And so I think that it's natural that pasta, which is such a perfect, beautiful carby base for a range of flavors, should be the vehicle for exploration.
And what I have to say I really love about this is I, like many people, have way too much stuff in my pantry. You know, I have the Japanese pantry, the Indian pantry, the Chinese pantry, and I have so many condiments that I don't use enough and they languish. Do I want to throw them away? No, because I know that they're like umami bombs. So for example, miso, I don't use miso enough. So give me an idea for that, for example.
Well, we have a very simple one, but this is like a phenomenal, you come home from work and you just need something comforting, shells with miso butter and scallions. So savory and delicious and simple. Then there's also a linguine with white clam sauce and miso. So it's a classic linguine with white clam sauce, but just add a little bit of miso in there and it just deepens the flavor. It adds umami, it adds savoriness and just makes it so phenomenal. And linguine with white clam sauce, it's funny, that's a dish that like I had only ever had in restaurants. I mean, I'm sure you cook it at home, Evan. You're a more experienced pro chef than I am. Like I would have thought it was like a once a year thing and then I cooked it to make it for this dish for the cookbook and I was like, oh, this actually isn't that complicated.
So let's talk about a couple of the flavor bomb pastas. The buziate, which I love as a shape, with roasted tomato butter and gim, the roasted Korean nori,
seaweed.
Basically.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that one is phenomenal. And I should say, you know, I worked with a team of incredibly talented recipe developers on this cookbook. I'm not a chef. The recipes, a big reason why they are so phenomenal is because of the contributions of my collaborators. And that recipe was, I worked with Asha Lupi on. She's a great recipe developer based in the Bay Area. And Asha, I'm sure you know, Evan, a lot of people know the Marcella Hazan tomato sauce with a stick of butter in it, basically. And everyone loves that one. And this is sort of just a riff on that. It's a very basic sauce, but you just add, again, you add a few components and it just ups the savoriness. You add a little bit of that seaweed in there, it adds umami, and it adds also just a slightly different textural component. Because as I said, I'm a big texture eater.
Also, I know a lot of people rely on packaged gnocchi for weeknight dinners because it's so easy to cook with it. You have a recipe that pairs it with bacon and sauerkraut, which I love. It's like this Eastern European kind of hug.
Yeah, no, that is an extremely comforting dish. Yeah, my wife's family is from Czechoslovakia, and I have learned some classic Slovak dishes through them. They have, the national dish of Slovakia is called brinzová halušky. It's like it's similar to potato gnocchi with like a sheep's milk cheese and bacon. And they also do one with the halušky, these little dumplings with sauerkraut and bacon. And that was the one I decided to adapt for this cookbook because it's so incredibly simple, but it's, if you've been out in cooler weather or spent some time outdoors and you want to come in and you want a cold drink and you want something comforting, this is something you can throw together and it's sort of salty and savory. And I love the crunch. I love the doughiness of the gnocchi with the crunch of the sauerkraut and the crispiness of the edges of the bacon. It just all comes together so nicely.
So I'm going back to cascatelli for a minute. What is your favorite way to eat them?
I mean, it depends a bit on my mood, but I'd probably say if I had to pick one, I would go with the Mapo Tofu Cascatelli recipe in this cookbook, which I worked with the great cookbook author Andrea Nguyen on. She did a Mapo Tofu spaghetti recipe years ago, so we collaborated to adapt it for cascatelli, and it's just, you know, cascatelli is so good at holding sauce, and the little bits and pieces of the ground meat from the Mapo Tofu sauce get inside the ruffles of the cascatelli. Andrea's stroke of genius in this dish is that, you know, traditionally with Mapo Tofu, you would cube the silken tofu, but instead she has you puree it into the sauce, which gives the sauce the thickness and richness and creaminess of a cream sauce, but without any dairy. It's pureed silken tofu. So the sauce has a very velvety, rich, decadent texture, but yet it doesn't feel heavy because there's no dairy in it. And so it's just got layers of spice with the Sichuan peppercorns and the doubanjiang, and then that creamy texture from the silken tofu, and it is just flavor for days.
Thank you so much, Dan.
My pleasure. Thanks as always, Evan.
That was Cascatelli's inventor and the host of the Sporkful podcast, Dan Pashman. His cookbook is Anything's Pastable, 81 Inventive Pasta Recipes for Saucy People. If you want to hear more conversations between myself and Dan, you can hear us live on Thursday, May 2nd at Chow Now in Culver City. Andy Richter's the host. We've got a link to buy tickets as well as the recipe for Dan and Andrea's Mapo Tofu Cascatelli at kcrw.com/goodfood. The market report is on deck, so stay with us. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. It's time to check in with Jillian Ferguson to see what's in peak season this week in Southern California.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. I am at the Santa Monica Farmers Market today with the executive chef of Kobe's on Main Street in Santa Monica. Arnie Marcella is here at the market shopping for his Southeast Asian-inspired menu. Hi, Arnie.
Hi, Jillian. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to see you here, and I'm so curious how you are incorporating these Southern California flavors from the market into a menu from Southeast Asia. Talk about how you do that.
Well, it's very exciting. You know, we look at obviously the product of what's peaking and what's coming into season the most for inspiration. And then, drawing back and relying on what are the flavor profiles that they represent, how do they compare to more indigenous or regional flavors, and how can we combine the two to uplift them, being both representative culturally of the cuisine's origin, but also representative of what's here in front of us right now.
So give us an example of how you do that on the menu right now. Maybe you can pick one savory dish and one sweet.
So for savory dishes right now, one market dish that I'm very excited about is embracing the summer squashes that are currently coming in. So we have a lot of different varieties of squashes, and combining them with salted fermented tofus and green almonds and chilies, of course, they're all flavors that mimic indigenous cuisine, indigenous products from Southeast Asia, and complementing them. Something in particular that stands out is green almonds. You know, green almonds are a short season, an exciting season here in America. They don't really exist in Southeast Asia, but have a very similar texture and flavor profile to a lot of the small green mangoes that are used in a lot of salads and yums throughout the region. So it gives us that texture and that grip to really uplift the dish, and reminds me a lot of the little snacks at the market in Southeast Asia.
So cool. And how do you treat the summer squash in that dish?
So it's a combination of marinated, raw, slices, ribbons. We fry some of the blossoms for texture, and then combine them all. So you have like crunchy chunks, really small, thin slivers, creamy and crumbly tofu, as well as the crunch and the herbs from onions and the green almonds as well.
Sounds incredible. So let's shift to sweet. What's on the sweet menu right now?
It's hard to avoid being attracted to the strawberries. You know, while they're common all year round, everyone gets most excited about right now, and for good reason. I think right now, in the last few weeks, we're starting to see a big turn in strawberries, not just in terms of varieties available, but in terms of flavor. So we're going to be putting on a sweet tofu cream and strawberry granita dessert with coconut jelly and Thai basil oil and coriander blossoms.
So talk about the sweet tofu cream. Is that something that you make in-house, or is that something that you buy?
It's something that we make in-house. We infuse it with pandan, and we sweeten it with palm sugar. So it has like this really nice richness to it. It's obviously, the whole dish becomes vegan, and it adds this creamy element that kind of that ties all of the flavors together, both the herbs and the sweetness of the fruit, but it definitely has that very distinct soy earthiness to it that brings us also back to Asia.
And is the texture kind of like a panna cotta?
It is, actually. It is like a very light panna cotta.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for all the inspiration, Arnie.
Thank you for having me.
That was Arnie Marcella, executive chef of Kobe's on Main Street in Santa Monica. They are open for dinner 7 days a week and for brunch on Saturdays and Sundays. One of the beloved strawberry vendors here at the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market is Gloria Tamai, who brings her strawberries almost year-round. But I'm looking at your table today, Gloria, and I can tell that the season is really ramping up. Can you tell us about the three varieties you have on the table today?
Okay. Right now, we have gaviotas, we have albians, and we have Monterey. The gaviotas, we only grow it in one season. And that's the one that's sweet and juicy and low in acid. The albians, we're trying to grow it all year round. Sometimes we cannot get the plants, so we have to plant the Monterey. But the albians is my favorite ones. They have that flavor, and it's sweet, and it's firmer. So those are my favorite. And then the Monterey is a strawberry. It's, sometimes it's real sweet, but it's not so flavor like the albion. Mm-hmm. And it's mayo. It's not like the other ones.
Yeah, the Monterey seems to me like what we would come to expect from a grocery store strawberry.
More like it, yeah, because I think it does more like a commercial mm-hmm. strawberry.
Paint us a picture of your fields. When you look at Tamai Family Farms at the table, you're growing not just strawberries, but tons of different row crops, broccolis, herbs, lettuces, everything. How many strawberry fields do you have?
Well, we plant like, I think about 2 acres, the Monterey or albions, you know, to have it all year round. And then we plant the other ones, like 5 acres for the season. And That's how we know which ones are which ones. Because, you know, like, we know when we are there in the field, we know which ones are the Monterey, which ones are the Albions, the Gaviotas. You can see it. It's a little darker ones, lighter. The Monterey and Albion look a little bit similar.
Yes, they do.
But flavor not the same.
Yeah. So how long has your family been growing strawberries?
Huh. I married my husband, and I've been married 40 almost 50 years. When I got married with him, my father-in-law is already growing the strawberries. And then I came in the family, and this is the day we've been having strawberries. I remember before, it used to be a different variety of strawberries. Oh. They used to have so many different before, but so far, I know my favorite one has been the Albion.
And that's why you've continued to grow it?
Yeah, we used to grow the Chandler's, Sequoia. We grow those 1 year, but those are too delicate, so we don't mess around with those no more. It's hard to find those plants now because the nurses don't come out always with new varieties every year.
And how are the new varieties?
We trying like at Daroma, we don't like that one. Mm-mm. Favorite ones? My Albions.
You know the classics. I love that. Great. So is the season's just ramping up right now?
Yes, it's right now. The season is right now. So probably to June.
Okay. When people buy your strawberries at the market and we take them home, how should we keep them at home?
You should put in a Tupperware with paper towel, dry in the bottle, and paper tap and top, and seal it in the fridge. Do not watch it till you're ready to eat it.
All right, Gloria. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome anytime.
That was Gloria Tamai of Tamai Family Farms in Oxnard. You can find their strawberries at 7 different markets across Southern California, including the Wednesday Santa Monica Market. And also, if you're in Oxnard, they're at the Harbor Market on Sundays. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen at kcrw.com/goodfood or on KCRW's mobile app. Of course, you can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or any podcast service you use. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Elena Shatkin, and to our engineers, Hope Brush and Sue Margulies, and a special thanks to Laura Kondarajan and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleinman. I want to give a big shout out to all of the vendors who are planning on selling pie at the marketplace during Pie Fest. Please support these small businesses who invested their time and money into preparing for this weekend's event. I'll be tagging all of them on my Instagram at @KCRWEvan this weekend so that you can support them. I'm Evan Kleinman, and I'll meet you back here next week for another episode of Good Food.